Diktat Sal Solo. Diktat.
Thrakken turned around to see General Bryman Yarar, the man in charge of the dig, jogging toward him.
News, sir. Maybe big news. The Drawl planetary repulsor just came alive.
What?
Just now, sir. The jamming is still in place, of course, so we can't get any more information. But our sensors just picked up a huge jolt of repulsor activity coming from Drawl. Unfocused, uncontrolled, but it's there.
I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
The Solonians, maybe they're good at underground work. The Overden has some good technicians, but the Drawlists, they were never anything.
In moments of honesty, Thrakken knew his own Human League forces were not exactly the cream of society. Thugs, most of them. Even with all the help he got from the Starbuster's masters, he had not been able to recruit many high-quality people. He had learned to accept that and view his troops as the best tools he could lay his hands on, if not the best tools for the job. But thugs or not, compared to the Drawlists, the Human Leaguers were perfect gentlemen and leading scientists, every one of them. Thrakken had at least been able to buy himself a few disgruntled technicians, some ex-Imperial soldiers and administrators, not the Drawlists. Whatever else you could say against the Drawlish species, the pompous little fools were, for the most part, relentlessly honest, upright, cautious people. There had actually been some sort of discontent on Corellia, and probably on Solonia and Talus and Trollis, around which to build a revolt. On Drawl, the rebellion had been, out of necessity, completely artificial. Even the Human League wouldn't have taken on humans as low down as the Drawlists. And Drawlist technical capability was no better than Drawlist behavior. Wait a minute, Thrakken thought. Wait just a moment. Maybe the Drawlists hadn't gotten it running. Maybe someone else had managed that little trick. Suddenly, he had a shrewd idea who that might be. He turned toward Yarar.
Get the best of the repulsive tech crews together along with a strike platoon.
He lifted the bottle to his lips and took a big swallow.
We're going to pay a little call on the Drawlists.
Luke watched the blinking light over the huge airlock chamber and wondered who was on the other side asking them in. He shut his eyes and reached out, probing with his force ability, searching for the feel of the station of the beings aboard it. He could detect exactly one sentient mind, a human one, a young woman. That mind seemed worried and afraid, but friendly enough for all of that. The deck of the airlock was littered with debris, bits of clothing, broken pieces of luggage, freight containers, abandoned machinery, even a small spacecraft with all its access ports open and its nose assembly removed. Obviously, it had been cannibalized for parts. The comm was activated.
Looks like some folks got out of here in a hurry.
Looks like, Luke answered Lando. But what exactly had they been in such a hurry to get away from? Luke made a nice, smooth landing, and the Lady Luck eased down on her repulsors in front of the X-Wing. The moment she landed, there was a shimmering in the space over their heads. Then the activated force field settled down into a thin blue haze that surrounded the two ships. Luke understood that by using a force field system, the station's controllers could avoid constantly pressurizing and depressurizing the chamber. No small issue with one this size. A tunnel, formed of the same blue haze, came into being just behind the Lady Luck. Luke could see that it led to a more conventional-sized inner airlock hatch. The incoming air whipped up some of the debris until the inside of the force field bubble was swirling with bits of paper and dust and torn-up packing material. The X-Wing rocked back on its shock absorbers as the air pushed at it. Luke watched his exterior gauges as the roaring subsided. At least as far as his instruments were concerned, it was perfectly normal air at perfectly normal pressure. He popped the canopy of the X-Wing and dropped lightly to the ground. As the others emerged from the Lady Luck, Luke heard a beeping from the topside of his X-Wing. Don't worry, R2, I haven't forgotten you. He reached out with the force and lifted R2 into the air and was just about to bring him down to the deck when the hatch at the end of the force field tunnel began to lumber open. Everyone turned to look. A tall, thin, pale-skinned woman with prominent eyebrows came in. She hesitated at the entrance for a moment, and then shrugged and walked toward them at a brisk clip. How are you doing that? She asked. And why?
Huh? Luke asked and looked up.
Oh! He had nearly forgotten that R2 was still hanging in midair. If he had lost any more concentration, R2 would have crashed to the deck. He landed him gently.
It's sort of a long story, Luke said.
I'll bet, the young woman said, giving Luke a quizzical look.
Well, anyway, I'm Jenica Sonson, C-Point C-00 Ad-Op.
What? Luke asked.
Sonson sighed. Sorry, force of habit. Center Point Chief Operations Officer, Administration and Operations. Basically, I run the place these days. The C-Point CE declared a bug out right after the first major flare incident, and the whole execsec evac'd along with practically all the C-Point CivPop. I wish I could get out of here, but I was OOD when the bug was called, so Reg said I was stay behind.
Luke was about to ask her what that meant when 3PO stepped forward.
Perhaps I might be of help, Master Skywalker. I believe that what Administrative Officer Sonson means is that Centerpoint's chief executive ordered a full evacuation after the first flare disaster, and the entire executive secretariat left along with most of the civilian populace. Although she wished to leave with everyone else, Administrative Officer Sonson happened to be the officer on duty at the moment when the evacuation was declared, and under those circumstances, she was automatically designated the officer to stay behind and serve as a caretaker.
She didn't say anything about a disaster, Lando said suspiciously.
I beg your pardon, but she did refer to a major incident. That is a common bureaucratic euphemism for catastrophe.
Hold it! The tin box got it all correct, but I am right here. You could ask me what I meant. Only if you promise to speak basic like everyone else, Lando said. For a moment, it looked as if Sonson were about to bite Lando's head off, but she backed down.
Oh, maybe you've got a point. But I have to know what you're doing here. Your ships blew out of nowhere, and then those fighters bugged out, too.
Were they your fighters? Kalinda asked. And what government do you represent?
The fighters you were shooting at? Now, they weren't Fed-Dub.
Fed-Dub?
Sorry, the Federation of the Double Worlds, Kalinda nodded.
The Federation is the duly elected government of Talos and Phallus.
You people still haven't told me who you are and what you're doing here.
Our apologies, Gariel said, speaking for the first time. She introduced them all. We are taking possession of Centerpoint Station in the name of the New Republic.
Well, good. It's about time somebody did. Come this way, and I'll show you where everything is. She turned around abruptly and started walking down the tunnel. On the opposite side of the lock chamber, they entered a waiting turbovator car. We might as well start out with Hollowtown. It's what everyone always wants to see first.
Hollowtown?
Lando asked. There was a second's pause.
You're not all that well briefed, are you?
Hollowtown is the open space in the exact center of the sphere. Where you docked was just about at the join between the North Pole, that's what the locals call the cylinders, the North and South Poles, and the central sphere. We're now moving parallel to the axis of rotation, sideways, in toward Hollowtown. We have to pass through about 20 kilometers of decks and shells first. A shell is what we call a real high-ceiling deck, anything over about 20 meters or so. There are about 2,000 levels, all told.
What were the flares you mentioned? Luke asked.
You people don't know about the flares?
Well, first we've heard of them. We just broke through the interdiction field into the system a few days ago.
Sonson let out a low whistle.
Broke through the interdiction field? That's something, all right. I'll bet whoever's creating that field isn't real happy with you just now.
Kalinda frowned. Hold it. Center Point Station is generating the interdiction field, and the communications jamming, for that matter. You didn't know that?
Nope, none of us here did.
Looks like my briefing wasn't so good either.
What you've got to understand about this place is that no one understands it, Sonson went on. We just live here. We didn't know why Center Point did most of the things it did, but we knew what most of them were, or at least we thought we knew, up until the terrorists started showing us a few tricks.
Oh, we just got here, Lando said. What terrorists?
Sonson shrugged her shoulders. No group has claimed responsibility. We have suspects, the Trata livers, the Two Worlders, and so on, but they all denied having anything to do with it.
Luke guessed that the Trata Libbers meant the Trollis and Talis Liberation Party or some such. Two-worlders probably meant some crowd that wanted separate governments for each planet. Tell us about the attacks. Sonson went to the turbovator car's viewport. You'll be able to see for yourself in a minute or two. Hollow Town used to be quite a place. It grew enough food for the whole station. It had parks and nice homes and lakes and streams. Then someone started messing with the glow point. The glow point being a sort of artificial sun, Luke asked. That's right. And someone made it go crazy.
Who normally controls the glow point? Bando asked. How does it work?
One theory is that it draws its power directly from the gravitational interflux between Talis and Trollis, but no one has been able to come up with an instrument to test the idea. A spot of light began to gleam through the end of the tunnel up ahead. That's the glow point. It's back to normal, at least for the moment. The humans in the group shielded their eyes against the sudden brightness. The glow point was just that, a glowing point of light suspended in midair in the precise center of the huge spherical chamber that was Hollow Town. It looked like a miniature sun, warm, comfortable, inviting. But there was nothing comfortable about the landscape below. Hollow Town had been charred to a land of ashes. Luke could see the skeletal remains of burned-out buildings, what had once been neatly planted orchards that were now nothing but rows of incinerated tree stumps. A lake had boiled dry. Normally, I'd stop the car at one of the intermediate stops and let you get out and look around, but there's just about no free oxygen left in there. All of it got consumed in the first flare, 30 or 40 days ago. Kalenda objected. That was before the jamming started. I came into the system about that time, and I never heard anything about this. It should have been big news. Now, we tried to keep it as quiet as we could. The Fed-dub government was weak enough as it was. And what terrorists want most is publicity. The Feds were afraid that if this got out, it could spark a panic or even a rebellion here. And I guess they were right. We could have kept news of this from getting to the other worlds, but the refugees all had to go to Talis and Trollis. The word spread, and we got our rebellions all right, one on Talis, two on Trollis. One group, I don't know which, landed a bunch of fighters somewhere on the South Pole a while back, claimed the station for themselves. What was I going to do, fight them off by myself? I left them alone, and they did the same to me, until you chased them off.
What do you mean, by yourself? Gabriel asked. Are you the only one still on the station?
Sonson shook her head. Probably not. It's a big place. I haven't seen anybody, but that doesn't mean anything.
You referred to the first flare, Bando asked. How many were there?
Two in all. The second happened just about a day or so before the interdiction field and the communications jamming came on.
Lando said a bit distractedly, This station is exactly at the center point, the barycenter between Talis and Trollis, right?
Right.
And the glow point is at the exact center of Hollow Town? And Hollow Town is at the exact center of the station?
It might be off by a centimeter or two. Feel free to get a measuring stick.
Lando ignored Sonson's sarcasm.
He pointed out across the huge spherical space toward the far side of the rotation axis and then tilted his head back to look through the overhead viewport.
Those conical structures coming up out of the north and south poles right on the rotation axis, what can you tell me about them?
The two clusters of cones seem to be identical. A larger central cone surrounded by six smaller cones.
Sonson shrugged. I can tell you that one set is called the South Conical Mountains, and the other is called the North Conicals. People try to climb them once in a while, but even in the near-zero gravity zone at the spin axis, it isn't easy. Just at that moment, R2's view lens swiveled up to take in an overhead view, and then he turned to 3PO.
Very well, R2, I will inquire, though it is very rude of you to interrupt.
3PO turned toward Jenica Sonson.
Pardon the intrusion, Administrator Sonson, but my counterpart wishes to know rather urgently if the two previous glow point flare events started suddenly, or if there was a gradual increase in the light source's brightness.
interesting droids you've got. As best we're able to tell, the brightness came up gradually over the course of about half an hour. R2 rocked back and forth on his roller legs, his head whirling.
Oh, dear, I quite agree. Captain Kelrizium, the visible light output from the glow point has increased 6% in the last 5 minutes.
The Duchess Marcia of Master Gophorus sat in the lounge of the Millennium Falcon, feeling downright gloomy. Her nephew, Ebrahim, was playing a dispirited game of sabacc with Jaina. The fact that Jaina had lost several hands showed just how low her spirits were. Q-9, or what was left of him, was propped up against the far bulkhead of the compartment. Jason had gone to meet Anakin, who he said was on his way back to the camp and feeling very bad. It was a miracle that none of them had been killed. Well, maybe Q-9 had been killed. At least Chewbacca had not been able to revive him. They were trapped here, and most of their rations had been outside the Falcon when the explosion occurred. March's best guess, which she had not shared with anyone, was that they had enough water and food for 6 days at most. Their one hope was that Chewbacca could get the Falcon's propulsion systems working again. The Wookiee was working on the problem now, rooting around in all the access panels, knee-deep in cables and burned-out parts. It seemed that the initial burst of repulsor power had knocked them out. In all likelihood, a similar electronic pulse had blown out Q-9. Marcia heard the sound of footsteps coming up the Falcon's entry ramp and looked up to see Jason and Anakin come into the lounge. Ebrahim and Jaina looked up as well, and Chewbacca, too, appeared in the door.
"Hi, everyone," Anakin said. "I'm back. I didn't mean to hurt anything. I'm sorry."
A miracle of understatement, that.
"It'll be all right, Anakin," Jaina said. "We'll find a way to fix it all, don't you worry."
Marcia exchanged a glance with her nephew and then with the Wookiee. Clearly none of them was in the mood for empty platitudes, but sometimes platitudes were all one had left.
"Of course it will be all right,"
she heard herself saying as she stood up and moved toward the boy.
"Come here, Anakin."
Suddenly the child burst into tears, rushed over to her, and flung his arms around her.
"There, there,"
she said, putting her arms around him.
"There, there."
"I suppose I won't like the answer if I ask you if this thing can go any faster," said Lando.
The turbovator car continued its stately descent down to the equator line of Hollowtown and the nearest way out. The glow point had started brightening when they were at the midpoint of their descent. Jenica Sonson shook her head.
"No, you wouldn't like the answer."
"How long until we're out of here?" Kalenda asked.
"Another 5 minutes or so, but there's a flaw."
"What flaw?"
Lando asked. "There's a pressure differential between the equatorial region of Hollowtown and Shell 1, the area on the other side of the lock. The main turbovator airlock jammed up during the second flare. I managed to get it working again, but it wasn't easy. And I'm not so sure my repair is going to hold up."
"So we're stuck."
"We're not stuck. There's a personnel lock right next to the turbovator airlock. It's smaller and simpler, and it got a lot more use, so it's a real heavy-duty job. If we can't get the turbovator lock running, we'll have to make a run for the personnel lock.
But you did happen to mention there's no oxygen left out there," Luke said.
"Well, even if there were any oxygen left, it would probably kill you to breathe in. Very high CO2 levels, plus all sorts of toxic burn products."
"Can we all make it into the lock at once?" Luke asked.
"Well, the lock is big enough, but I don't think we should try all at once. I'll have to open the turbovator door by hand, run for the lock, and get it open. We should do it in two passes."
"If you have to run for the other airlock,"
Lando said,
"I'll go with you. I used to run a place called Cloud City. I had to go in and out of a toxic atmosphere a lot."
"Lando, if anyone should go with her, it should be me," Luke said.
"No, your Jedi powers give you the best endurance. We might all need your help."
The wind began to howl as the car moved lower and lower into nightmare dust storms. The glow point was heating the lower, thicker layers of air at a different rate than the upper layers. In a spinning, inside-out world, hot and cold air at different pressures was a recipe for serious weather. A wall of gritty dust enveloped the car, cutting off the view. The car slowed until it was barely moving. The swirling clouds cleared for a moment and revealed a large two-story building directly ahead.
"Not the main entrance complex for this sector," said Thompson. The turbovator's track led to a large set of pressure doors.
"So, let's see what happens. I'll let the automatics try it first."
The car eased to a halt in front of the doors, which started to move apart smoothly enough, but then jammed up when they were only about a meter apart.
"All right, then," said Lando. "Looks like we get out and walk. Time to do a little preparation."
He pulled his blouse off, pulled out his vibroshiv, and started slicing the blouse into ribbons. He stuffed one larger wad of cloth in his pocket and passed the others around.
"Wrap one of these around your mouth and nose. If you pass out or your breathing reflex gets the better of you, a little cloth might filter out the worst of it."
"Let's hope the personnel airlock opens so fast that you've lost your shirt for nothing," Sonson said.
Lando grinned. "It breaks my heart to mess up my wardrobe when I don't need to, but I think I could deal with it just this once. Where's the other airlock?"
"It's about 10 meters to the left of the main airlock. It should be matched to pressure on the other side, but it shouldn't take long at all to match." Sonson looked up at the ceiling of the car where the air tanks were hanging. "Match pressure. Wait a second, I just got an idea. If we dumped the air from those tanks into the car here, we could get air pressure higher than the outside. Then when we open the door, our air would push out instead of the bad air pushing in.
And we'd have a pressure curtain. Good idea. Then the second group could close the doors after we go and maybe still have some air to breathe."
Lando boosted Sonson up and she reached for the pressure regulator, then cranked it up as high as it would go. The air started flowing almost at once. "Lando and I will get out as fast as we can and run to the other lock. Give us 3 minutes, no more, no less, and then pop the door again and come running."
"Got it," Luke said.
"Okay," Lando said. "Tie your clothes on."
He looked out the viewport at the swirling clouds of murky ash and soot and shook his head.
"All right, R2, you time it. The rest of you, come after us in 3 minutes. Let's do it."
Sonson tied her own cloth over her mouth and nose, then hit the door open button.
The air blew out of the turbovator car with terrifying speed, and then a blast furnace of air rushed in, pulling a stream of noxious dust and smoke and soot with it. Sonson dove through the door and Lando followed her. Once they made it to the airlock, Sonson tried to work the old-fashioned-looking controls, but the metal buttons and knobs were already too hot to touch. Lando handed her another piece of cloth. Sonson wrapped it around her hand and threw back the spill lever, equalizing pressure between the interior and exterior of the lock. The door slid open. The dust and smoke swirled around in the wretched air as Lando stumbled into the oven-hot interior of the lock and suddenly realized that Jenica was not with him. He turned to find her slumped over by the lock entrance, face down on the ground, coughing and retching. Half blinded by the caustic chemicals burning his eyes, Lando hauled Jenica into the lock. He was about to let her slump down onto the deck when he realized just how hot it had to be by now. He threw her left arm over his shoulder and held her up as he searched frantically for the inside lock controls. Still coughing, she pointed an unsteady finger to one corner of the lock. He dragged himself over, Jenica still draped over him, and pulled the closed lock lever, burning his hand in the process. He had his finger jammed down on the air pump button almost before the door latches had closed, but the automatics cut in at once anyway, not pumping in good air, but dumping the bad stuff out into the other side of the lock. Lando's lungs were screaming for air. He felt as if he were about to pass out, but he knew he did not dare. If he fainted, his reflexes would start him breathing again, and that would probably kill him. The pressure equalized, and the far lock door opened. The hot, bad air expanded out into Shell 1, and good, cool air swept into the lock chamber. They could not breathe easily just yet, not until the dust and smoke dispersed, but at least they could breathe. Jenica went to the Shell 1 side control panel and pulled the old-fashioned lever to swing the interior door shut.
"Hold it!"
Lando had spotted a rack of emergency equipment by the door, including two small oxygen tanks with breathing masks. He grabbed one, twisted the valve to start the oxygen flowing, and threw it into the lock. Maybe there was just enough oxygen to blow around and do some good. Luke Skywalker watched R2 intently, waiting for the 3 minutes to be up. The temperature in the car had jumped dramatically when the outside air had come in. All of them were sweating profusely, and all of them, even the Jedi Master himself, were having trouble breathing. About another 30 seconds. Kalenda? Gariel, are you ready? No, not really, said Gariel, coughing. But I doubt I ever will be. Let's go, she said. Kalenda nodded. Here we go. Luke hit the button. A new blast of burning hot air struck at them as the door opened. Luke got one fleeting moment of good visibility before the roaring wall of dust and cinders enveloped them. One moment when he saw where the airlock hatch was and saw that it was swinging open for them. He reached out with the Force and found Kalenda and Gariel just a meter or two ahead of him. They were headed in the wrong direction. Luke lunged forward, guiding himself with the Force, and grabbed Kalenda by the hand and yanked hard in the proper direction. He could feel Gariel hesitate a moment, then follow. He still did not dare open his eyes, but he knew they were at the entrance to the lock. He pushed Kalenda and Gariel in before stepping in himself and running smack into something metal and tall. It was 3PO.
It would seem R2 and I got here before you, Master Luke.
There was a sudden flare of orange behind Luke. Gariel's long, flowing white dress was on fire, and she did not know it. Luke lunged for her and threw his body on the flames, trying to smother them. His flight suit was insulated and fireproof. He felt a brief bloom of heat on his chest, and that was all. He stood back up and helped Gariel to her feet. A red-hot bit of debris must have gotten lodged in the fabric of Gariel's dress, but how could it burn with no available oxygen? Luke heard a hissing noise from behind him and looked around. An oxygen mask. Lando and Kalenda had thrown an oxygen mask into the lock chamber, and Gariel had been standing right on top of it. Her dress must have trapped the oxygen, a million to one shot, but one that had almost killed her. All of that flashed through his mind even as he was grabbing for the mask. He tore the cloth strip off her mouth and put the oxy mask over her mouth and nose. Still half-blinded and probably still unaware of why Luke had knocked her over, she jerked away from the mask at first until she realized what it was. Then she grabbed for it greedily and took in a deep, urgent breath. Luke handed the mask to Kalenda, who took two deep breaths herself before handing it back to Luke. Luke exhaled the last breath he had breathed back in the turbovator car and sucked in as much as the mask had to give. I was on fire? Gariel asked, looking down at the remains of her dress. Jenica had led them all to a small infirmary near the Shell One side of the airlock. Everyone had cuts and bruises and minor burns. They all needed baths and clean clothes as well, but those could wait. I apologize for throwing that oxy mask in there, said Lando.
Don't apologize, Gariel said. The mask probably saved all our lives. I was near passing out.
Jenica Sonson seemed bemused. This was no terrorist attack. To set off flares twice didn't make a great deal of sense, but three times?
I think you're wrong there, Lando said. But I'm afraid your people here weren't the intended victims.
What do you mean? Luke asked.
Center point is right in the middle of it all. Think about it. There are three big inexplicable technologies at the middle of this crisis. The first and the easiest to explain is the system-wide jamming. And where does the jamming come from?
Center point, Jenica said, without FedDub even knowing about it, and we ran the place.
Or at least you thought you did. Second is the interdiction field. Where does it come from?
Center point. And the third unexplained technology? Luke asked.
The Nova Maker. Of course. The Starbuster. We all wondered where the Starbuster was. I'm just about positive we're sitting in it right now. I think the glow point flare means it's about to go off again.
It was a lovely morning.
The star Corel was rising in the east. The rolling hills and clean blue sky of Salonia were laid out before them. The Hunchuzuk Den had installed Han, Aunt Leia and Mara when they joined him, in a splendid hilltop villa, clearly built for the use of visiting human dignitaries. "I am tired of waiting, Drachmas," Han said.
"Patience, Anna Solo. Waiting is not yet tired of you."
Han Solo turned to his wife, who was sitting at the breakfast table. "You see what I've had to put up with?" He turned back to Drachmas, who had come to pay her morning call, as she did every day. "I'm still not sure why we're here. Right from the moment you yanked me out of that cell, I haven't known if I was your partner or your prisoner."
"I'm afraid it's not that simple. To my people, these things, partner, prisoner, hostage, negotiator, are not so separate from each other as they are with your folk. In our tradition, one might be one of these, or all at once, or some changingly over time."
"So which is it?"
"It is not yet determined."
"Traditions make for an awfully handy set of excuses," Mara said. "Every time I have ever dealt with a Salonian who didn't want to do something, she's explained to me how tradition made it impossible. No more. This isn't some trade deal for luxury goods where you can leave us hanging for 6 months on the off chance that your convenient traditions will get us so frustrated that we will give up and offer a better price. This is war."
"What is the meaning of your words?"
"In 1 hour, I am going to walk around to the landing pad on the other side of this villa. I am going to board the Jade's Fire, and I am going to fly away. The only way to prevent my departure is to have our group meet with someone in authority. My companions are welcome to join me if they wish, but I will be leaving in any event."
"And I'll be with her," said Han.
Leia looked troubled, but she nodded. "And so will I." Drachmas looked from one of them to the other.
But
you have 1 hour. Go, make things happen," Mara said. Drachmas dropped to all fours and rushed away as fast as she could. Leia was angry. "If I didn't believe in the power of a united front, I would have refused to go along with you. I'm a diplomat, and you're not. You should have let me do the talking." "I've been letting you do the talking," Mara replied. "All that's gotten us so far is an enforced vacation at this villa. I'm a businesswoman, a trader. Negotiation is my stock in trade. I had to let them know they'd lose everything if they didn't ask for something right now. Maybe if we can figure out what's going on around here, we can make some good decisions. There's something we need to consider. Drachmas told us that all these worlds have repulsors, and that someone from the outside was helping to organize the search for them. We've seen all sorts of indications that the various rebellions on the Corellian worlds regard the repulsors as being hugely valuable, but I have a hunch that the repulsor searches aren't because of the revolts. My guess is that the revolts are happening as a cover for the repulsor searches." "That makes sense if it's someone from outside doing the organizing," said Leia. "I can't quite see the racist thugs in the Human League approaching their close personal friends in the Salonian Overden to put this together. If I were the outside force setting up the deal, I'd say something like, cooperate with us, use your local people to dig up the repulsor for us, hand it over, and when we kick the New Republic out, we'll give you a free hand on your own planet.
Except then you run the risk of the rebels deciding that the repulsors were worth something," Han said.
"At a guess, something like that is what happened with the Human League," Mara said. "The externals are probably the ones running the Starbuster, not the Human League. When the Human League started tossing threats around, the external force couldn't have been too happy about it."
"Sooner or later," Leia said, "the interdiction field in the Chamming will be turned off. But if Thrak and Sal Solos manage to grab a few of the repulsors by then, he'll have some serious bargaining chips." Leia thought for a moment. "If all this is true, cut the links between the rebels and the external forces, gain control of the repulsors, figure out how to use them against the externals, and the rebellions ought to dry up and blow away."
"Fine," Han said.
Very nice and neat. I don't see how we could even start to accomplish any of those jobs.
He turned to Mara. Do you have an idea how the Salonians fit into all this? Are the Overden and the Henshizuk even still fighting each other? It wouldn't surprise me if they had stopped fighting. But if they have, that's probably bad news for us. It would mean that the Overden has seized control of the Repulsor. A lot of times we humans fight on, even when all hope is lost. Honor requires it, or we're hoping for a miracle, or we're praying that a million-to-one chance breaks our way. Not the Salonians. Typically, a fight between two groups ends when one side or the other demonstrates they have a massive advantage over the other. The Salonians, on the losing side, will ally themselves with the winners. There was a new voice at the door.
The inestimable Mara Jade has described the situation exactly.
The newcomer was an older-looking Salonian, tall but a little stooped over. Her fur shot through with gray.
I am Klaevitz, and I speak for the Overden. We have won our Hunshuzuk sisters over to our cause.
She paused, then smiled, displaying an unpleasantly impressive collection of teeth.
And that means that we have also won all of you.
Thrin, Zubik, Mortis, Norchow, Normal.
Normal processing resumes.
Reset, Wilder.
The stream of babble continued as Q9X2's head spun around and a forest of probes and sensors and manipulator arms popped in and out of their compartments. Anakin frowned.
Not quite.
The little boy pushed the droid's main power button off and reached into Q9's interior and unplugged a cable.
This one was in backwards.
He plugged the cable back in and turned the power back on. This time, the droid powered up a bit more sedately. He beeped twice and announced,
Normal processing resumes.
Well, I should hope so,
said Ebrahim.
After all that trouble we have been through in order to get you fixed.
Ebrahim left the droid with the children and returned to the Millennium Falcon. His aunt was sitting at the pilot station using a pile of old clothes under her ample rump to boost her up high enough to see all the instruments.
Greetings, Aunt. Is there anything to report?
She shook her head.
No, there is not. And for that, let us be profoundly grateful.
Suddenly she stopped talking and looked at the overhead detector display.
It would appear I spoke too soon.
And she slapped down the red alert button.
Aunt, what is it?
It's a ship coming in right on top of us.
It's amazing how much you can find when you know where to look, said Lando, studying the data flowing over the screen. And it doesn't hurt to have someone as good at data searches as R2. And, well, even 3PO's language skills have been helpful.
3PO turned his head briskly.
Helpful? I would say they have been essential. You wouldn't have been able to translate a tenth of that information without me.
Don't push it.
Yes, you were a great help, all right?
There, I said it. But I was about to say that without Administrator Sonson, we wouldn't have gotten anywhere at all.
Jenica Sonson smiled broadly and gave Lando a jab in the ribs. All I did was show you the log files. But the log files had told them a lot and led them in a lot of profitable directions. It was all down there, very clear.
I've now pretty much confirmed what I suspected the second I saw those conical forms in Hollowtown. That form of six small cones around a larger one is the exact geometry you need for an old-style repulsor.
But all the inhabited planets have their own repulsors, Galinda objected. What did the builders of Corellia need this place for?
Because this isn't just a repulsor. This is a hyperspace repulsor. This station was designed to open up a tunnel through hyperspace, grab a planet, and pull it back this way. It acts as more of a tractor beam than a repulsor, really.
But why would they use a space station as a super tractor beam? Jenica asked.
Lando shook his head. That's not the question. The question is, why did your people use the hyperspace tractor repulsor as a space station?
The architects of this star system built Centerpoint, used it, finished with it, and left it alone. The structure you call Hollowtown was never intended as a place to live. It was a containment facility for the massive energies the tractor repulsor put out as it was charging up.
Are you saying that Hollowtown is just a power storage battery?
Pretty much.
We're getting a little off point here, Kalenda said. Can you show us why you think Centerpoint is the Starbuster?
Well, first off, either you take my word for it, or I can show you the math to demonstrate that the form and level of power needed to pull a planet in through a hyperspace link can be converted into the power needed to induce a compression wave in a star's core. If the tractor repulsor energy is directed at the core of a star and concentrated in a burst, the burst will be sufficiently powerful to touch off a nova explosion.
We'll take your word for it, Jenica said hurriedly.
Now, looking at what's happened recently, this is the pattern I can put together. First off, Centerpoint Station suddenly reorients its spin axis drastically. Then there were a lot of unexplained power surges and unscheduled energy pulses reported in the station log. Then the first glow point flare happens. Shortly thereafter, the first induced supernova happens. Then civil war breaks out. Just after the first supernova, Centerpoint shifts its spin axis again. Then there's a different sort of power flow from the automatic recording instruments, and they start at exactly the time the jamming and the interdiction field come on. Then we get the second glowpoint flare. And then the second supernova.
Lando brought up a holographic projector and threw an image of the stars near Corellia.
The red spot at the center of the display is our position. This is the position of Centerpoint's south pole relative to the starfield before things started happening.
A blue line streaked out from the center of the display and pointed toward nothing at all.
This is the pointing after the first shift in spin orientation.
A line of red lanced out and stabbed straight through the heart of a star.
That's TD-1036 EM-1271, the first star to go nova.
Lando punched in another command, and a shaft of gold streaked out and touched another star.
Fanta Zilbra, the second star on the list. A population in the tens of thousands. I know the New Republic sent a rescue mission, but I don't know how they possibly could have gotten everyone out in time. And this is where we're pointed now.
A line of violet fire flashed out and hit another star, square and true.
This is the third star on the hit list Mara Jade got in the initial warning message. Bavo Yagan. I looked it up. One source says one planet with 8 million. Another says two planets with a total estimated system population of 12 million. Centerpoint is the Starbuster. And it is getting set to blast that star and those planets and all those people to cinders and dust.
When? Kalenda asked. Lando hit another control button and a countdown clock appeared.
Centerpoint is going to have to send a tractor repulsor hyperspace burst in exactly 123 hours, 10 minutes, and 13 seconds in order to keep to the schedule in the warning message. 12 hours and 12 minutes after that, the star's core will go.
Burning stars. Centerpoint, my home, is a weapon, Jenica said. Wait a second, Luke said. There's a piece that doesn't fit. If Centerpoint is the Starbuster, then it's the prize. Why the fuss over the planetary repulsors?
3 reasons, Lando replied. The first is, they already had it, or at least had found a way to control it. I figure there is some well-hidden control room on this station, some place we wouldn't find if we looked for 100 years. Probably there isn't anyone in it anyway. All of it automated, set to work off timers and remote control. Second reason might be plain old misdirection. If you get everyone worried about the repulsors, no one's going to have time to go looking for the Starbuster. And the third reason...
has been staring us right in the face, Kalenda said. Part of what makes repulsors work is that they can interfere and resonate with each other, right? Power to a small side repulsor cell can deflect the beam from the main repulsor.
Lando nodded. Exactly. In theory, you could tune all the planetary repulsors into a single network slave to Centerpoint. Just imagine Centerpoint with that much power.
It would be able to strike at any point in the galaxy.